So you can see when somebody has a stroke, an infarct stroke, that's the evolution. Now let's talk, what does a hemorrhagic stroke look like? It looks like, that was the next image we were at. We went through that, is right here. This is what a hemorrhagic stroke, is that different than an infarct stroke? Absolutely. What do you think is the most common cause of a hemorrhagic stroke in human beings? What would cause blood to burst out into your brain like this that we've talked about? Hypertension is number one. You can imagine if the blood pressure gets high enough, it'll blow out your blood vessels. This is a hemorrhage. This is a stroke that usually occurs in the white matter coming off the middle meningeal artery where you have a finer branches called the lenticulate striate vessels. And you can see it blew out the left cerebral hemisphere. That's a hemorrhagic stroke. You can see with now blood filling it up, it can cause a mass effect and lead to brain herniation. So that's why it's important to distinguish between an infarct as a stroke versus a hemorrhagic stroke. You can see why somebody could die from this very quickly because of the mass expansion within a confined space we call the calvarium, where the brain is located, that's made of jello. You can imagine. And you can imagine if you had it's tofu, would you had a hemorrhage? That's why when you think of shaking baby syndrome, you do not want to shake a baby, because what you're doing is shaking tofu in a container. And it can rupture the brain, the blood vessels, and cause intraparenchymal hemorrhage that way. So it's critical to realize the consistency of the brain and what a hemorrhagic stroke looks like. And so this is going to take what? Shorter or longer time to heal if you happen to survive something like this? Longer, because now you got blood to deal with it besides the brain parenchyma. And so this could be quite devastating. Obviously, the ultimate complication in this case was death as a consequence. Okay? Does everybody feel comfortable between the difference between when somebody says a stroke, what's the first question you ask? Is it ischemic or is it hemorrhagic? This is very important. Because then you've got to understand what's going on in this process. So we go back to these locations. We saw this image before in the beginning. And we have to look at bleeding. One, we saw the parenchyma, due to hypertension. What's another group of people that can lead to bleeding like that? Are diabetics and Alzheimer's patients. We'll get to why Alzheimer's when we get there in a moment. In diabetes, because of uncontrolled glucose, it can damage the endothelial cells. It can now damage the basement membrane and cause the blood vessels to become leaky, and they're structurally weaker, and therefore they can rupture. And if they have hypertension, they increase their likelihood of having a hemorrhagic stroke. In the case of Alzheimer's, what happens is you have amyloid protein accumulating in the blood vessels, making it structural weak. We talked about that, structural weakness, and can lead to hemorrhage spontaneously, whether you have hypertension or not, in the brain in somebody who has Alzheimer's as one of the complications. So when we look at this diagram, we have the epidural. And so what do we call that hemorrhage? We call it epidural hemorrhage. It means that the middle meningeal artery has been torn. And this is obviously trauma to the side of your head, because it's in the dura mater and the skull. So if you have severe force, you get a rapid expansion there, and it has to dissect the dura away from the skull. We'll look at that. Another type of hemorrhage is a subdural, underneath the dura mater. In number two is the space. And this is typically in older people. Why? What happens to your brain when you get older? What happens to its size? It atrophies. So if the brain is now atrophied, it has more space. So now if they hit the ground, they can now shear, or you have trauma in the automobile accident, they can shear the bridging vein that now leads to a hemorrhage that's subdural, but this is a venous side. And you can die months later or acutely from a subdural. The next place is subarachnoid. We see that artery in the third space. They will complain about the worst headache of their life because they have rapid expansion, because this is a high-pressure system coming off, and most common cause is usually aneurysms. either bury congenital, like in, for example, if you had polycystic kidney disease or some other condition, or if you had an atherosclerotic aneurysm, it ruptured, and you have the worst headache of your life because you have rapid expansion of the subarachnoid space with blood leaking in there quickly and irritating the meninges. And then we just talked about hypertension, where you blow out a blood vessel within the brain parenchyma, typically in the white matter. Yes? The question is, could you have hemorrhage? Usually we're going to talk about this is called a coup. Coup means in French blow, like you're describing. Say somebody comes along and hits me with a baseball bat. Okay. What I would see is the transmission of the force on the scalp. So I'd see scalp injury or hemorrhage. I could fracture the skull because of, depending upon the force. And because I'm hitting the brain, that force or kinetic energy will be transmitted to the surface of the brain, and I would see hemorrhage and necrosis on the surface, like a bruise or contusion. Versus a intraparenchymal, it would be in the white matter. It'd be very difficult. The patient would have to have his brain ruptured with a tremendous force. That's not going to be done. You could see some subarachnoid hemorrhage tends to occur at the base of the skull. This would be here. You may see some hemorrhage in the subarachnoid from that area, but it's localized to here. A subdural is unlikely because you're smashing on the surface of the brain. It's a possibility, but less likely. And obviously, you have to hit the middle meningeal artery right here in order to shear that off to get it. But you could get it in that scenario, but it depends upon the force that that head receives and where anatomically. Does that help answer your question? Okay, good. Now, this is what happened is, let's say I'm standing at a bus stop, or I'm in BART station, or Muni, wherever you want to be, and somebody comes along, hits you on the surface of the brain on the right side. You notice you see hemorrhage. There's the subdural and maybe subarachnoid hemorrhage, but then you see it's damage to the surface of the brain because it's hitting on the outside of the brain. This is called coup. This is contra coup. Let's say I faint, and now what happens is I fall and hit my left side of the head. Because my head is accelerating, the first thing that's going to hit the ground, remember we got three things that are accelerating, the skull and the skin, that hits first. The cerebral spinal fluid, because of the centrifugal force, is going to pool. And then as the brain hits that cerebral spinal fluid, is going to bounce off and hit the opposite side of the brain. This is called contra coup. Where's the most common place to see contra coup? Is your frontal lobes. When you fall forward, the first reactive thing you're going to do is what? Is put your hands out. But if you fall backwards, what's going to stop your fall? The back of your head. Try it at home if you want to experiment. But use a bed, obviously, or somebody you trust. So when you see somebody hitting the back of the head, then it's the frontal lobes that become damaged. So you notice this is all on the surface of the brain. Like here. This is the frontal lobe. And here you see all this hemorrhage. And you can see olfactory bulb right here on the right side. You see all this hemorrhage. It's all on the surface of the brain. Then years later, the brain gets reabsorbed, and here you can see this is an old organizing contra coup, and we see a golden brown pigment. Those are the macrophages that have eaten up the red blood cells, and it's now giving you hemosiderin-laden macrophages, and now you can see why you would damage your olfactory bulbs and have a problem with smell as a consequence to the damage of a contra coup. Okay? This is an example of a concussion, or somebody's getting hit and where you get actually necrosis. When you get a concussion, what part of the brain is being injured is the surface of the brain. Like football players, they're always worried about concussion effects. So you can imagine the more concussions you have, what happens to the brain parenchyma? Permanently or reversibly damaged? Permanent. So you can imagine you can lead to severe neurologic deficits if you don't stop getting concussions, because you can get a contusion on the surface. Concussion is you can't see it morphologically, but if you get enough concussions, you can eventually, it'll become a contusion. Now you have neuronal loss. The one on the right is an infarct because it's following the first cells to die in an infarct is what? Neurons. And so here you can see it's going along the gray cortex. It's deeper. So you can tell the difference between a contusion on the surface of the brain versus that's on an infarct. Remember, when a concussion is neurologic symptoms, if you did an MRI, you wouldn't see anything. So a contusion is one step where you see morphologic damage. Okay? But the more concussions you get, the more permanent neurologic damage you can get. And it can eventually lead to contusion if the force is hard enough. That's why football players wear what? Helmets. If they weren't wearing helmets, you'd see contusions like this. No, concussions won't show. Contusions will, because you can see damage to the surface of the brain. It's gross morphologic damage. See that on the surface? You can see that on a CT scan or MRI. If you get enough damage and you get multiple, then you'll see it. But it'll be over multiple episodes. But the first several times, you won't. Now, this is what an epidural hematoma looks like. Here's somebody who has a skull fracture. This is an autopsy. You can see the fracture is right here in the midline. And here's the tough mother, or dura mater. And this is what they call a lucid period. So if you have somebody suspected has had head trauma, and they say they're fine, well, they're probably feeling fine because they could die of a subdural hematoma, or a epidural hematoma, because it takes time for that pressure, an artery, to build up enough blood to dissect off the dura. See how the dura is attached to the left side of the slide where it's very tightly adherent to? And so it takes time for the blood to get enough pressure and dissect off the dura. Now as it dissects off, what is it going to do to the brain? Push on it, compress it, leading to a mass effect. And that's why they call it a lucid period. It takes time for that blood to build up enough pressure to then dissect off the dura and produce a mass effect and now impinge on the brain. And there's the epidural hematoma. Localized collection of blood. In this case, a potential space. This is what the dura looks like if you lift it off the surface of the brain. You here see a bridging vein. So this is the one where if you have head trauma and the brain in an older person is moving, it can cause the shearing forces to rupture it, and now you get a blood clot, a venous pressure underneath the dura. And this is what it looks like at autopsy. Here you see the scalp has been reflected onto the surface of the face. So here we're looking down at the brain. So this is the left side. And you see this large blood clot or hematoma. And it's now compressing on the brain. So this is going to lead to a mass effect leading to brain herniation. This you can see. What do you notice about the brain here on the left cerebral hemisphere versus the brain? What do you notice about it? It's compressed down. You see the compression? So when you have an epidural hematoma, it's doing the same thing, but it's on the outside where the dura is now pressing on it. Here is the blood clot on the surface of the brain that's pushing down on it and leading to brain herniation. A hematoma can heal. Instead of being that dark red-brown material, it can look like chocolate. And here you see an organizing because macrophages are coming in and hemolyzing it. And so it's like looks like dark chocolate. So this tells us this is a organizing subdural hematoma. So you can die of a subdural hematoma months later after the initial cause. What age do you think of? What's older? Elderly. Just make it real simple. And your definition of elderly better match up to the age range. Okay? Then, this is what a baryaneurysm at the base of the brain coming out the circle of Willis. You see this rapid expansion of blood in the subarachnoid space at the base of the brain. And here you see a large aneurysm. Here's an aneurysm on the left that's intact, and here's that blew out. It's like an explosion, you think of, in this rapid expansion of the subarachnoid space. The worst headache of your life you get. Somebody complains about that, and aspirin obviously is not going to help relieve this. They need to be taken to the emergency room ASAP, because you don't want to have a mass effect and lead to permanent neurologic damage. Any questions about circulation? That's very important to you as physical therapists. Any questions? Next category, third on our list, is developmental anomalies. On the exam, I'm not going to ask any questions about this. It's for your reference, okay? See, we're reviewing for the exam as we go through this content. So neural tube defects. When the neural tube forms on the embryonic plate, it's going to be like a zipper. It starts in the middle and goes anteriorly and posteriorly, or caudal and rostral. So where the defects occur is at the ends, where the zipper doesn't complete itself. So in the case of the brain, you don't form the brain. We call it anencephaly, because what does an mean? Without the brain. If it's a problem of closure at the distal part, we call that, that you think of spina bifida is an example. There are malformations that can occur. One that I will describe to you is Arnold-Chiari malformation. It involves the posterior fossa where the cerebellum fits in the skull, and there's a problem where it now goes through the foramen magnum and is where downward displacement. Or the skull forms abnormally in a posterior fossa and then leads to a small fossa, and then the cerebellum can't form correctly, and then it'll go through the foramen magnum. Sphingomyelia means cyst or cavity-like structure. It occurs in the spinal cord. You have the spinal canal, which is a connection to the fourth ventricle, and you can have a cystic space forming, and it can cause, obviously, damage to the spinal cord in these patients. If you hear the word cerebral palsy, that term means that the patient has had what during, at the time of birth, or perinatal, is a lack of oxygen. This is due to hypoxic injury that one sees when you hear the term cerebral palsy. It means that there's been hypoxic injury to the neurons at the time of birth, or perinatal, around the time of birth, okay? So here we see spina bifida. You think it at the end of the spine. And spina bifida, you get a little tuft of hair. And you can see this incomplete closure. You see part of the dura in red sticking out. Then you see that it's going up to the skin, the dura, the cerebrospinal fluid, the spinal cord of the caudae quinae, the horse's tail, where the nerve roots is coming off the end of the spinal cord. It's not there. When you call it a meningomyocele, you can see that myo meaning the spinal cord is now in that sac. Now it's close to the, now there's no skin covering it. You just have the dura. And then you have no dura and you have your spinal cord or the caudae quinae exposed to the outside. Which is worse to have? Because that's telling you it's myocele. It just means that now the spinal cord is now sticking out. Versus spina bifida. Occulta, what does occulta mean? Hidden. Can't see it. Remember, you get to use that dictionary. This is what Arnold-Chiari looks like. What do you notice about the size of the cerebellum relative to the size of the cerebral hemispheres? Is that big or small? Small, and you can see how this could go through the foramen magnum. Because now this, what would the patient have with? It'd get ataxia. Because the cerebellum is what? Destroyed, and so you have abnormal limb movements because of this. Or coordination. That's the third category. The fourth category, this is very common that you're going to see in patients because people get demyelinating diseases like Guillain-Barré of the peripheral nerves, or MS, multiple sclerosis, because it's a damaging of the oligodendrocytes that myelinate your CNS. We'll talk about neurodegenerative disease like Alzheimer's. We think of Lewy body dementia. We'll talk about Parkinson's. And these are problems of degradation of molecules. So they can't degrade the molecules properly, and they accumulate and causes these insidious onset that's going to take years to develop as a consequence, classically. We'll start with MS, multiple sclerosis. This typically occurs in young adults and middle-aged and elderly, but typically middle-aged and young adults at your age. And so typically, you see, this is remind you that when we talk about oligodendrocyte, how many axons does one oligodendrocyte myelinate? One or more than one? More than one. That's important. Is there a basement membrane around those myelin proteins or membranes wrapping around the axons? Yes or no? No. And that's quite different than the peripheral nervous system that has only one Schwann cell myelinating one axon, and you have a basement membrane tube. So MS, multiple sclerosis, is a hypersensitivity reaction type 4. We have cytotoxic TH cells going in and destroying the oligodendrocytes. Now, MS is a very interesting story because it can be progressive. It can have one attack and stay stable for the rest of the person's life, or it gets progressively worse and further attacks as a function of time. So when you look at the brain, it's affecting the white matter initially. And what you look at is, this is a fresh brain. And if you look at this brain carefully, you'll notice that if you look at the angles of the lateral ventricles, which are here, the normal white matter is this area right here. But then what do you notice? If I took off the white matter, what should the color become? Darker or lighter in color if I take out the white matter, which is lipid? What would you anticipate the area of demyelination should look relative to white matter? If you take out the oligodendrocytes that make up the white matter, should become darker or lighter in color? Becomes darker in color. So if you look right here, this is an MS plaque. This is what it looks like. This is all demyelinated because we see that normally it should be white, like this area that's normally myelinated. And you'll notice it's bilateral distribution. If you look at the angle of the right lateral ventricle, you also see that demyelinated area on the plaque as well. Then if you look carefully, here's the white matter here, but we see demyelinated plaque here. Here's another plaque here, another plaque here, another plaque here, another plaque here, and here's another plaque here, because it should be what color? White. In this case, it's darker in color, and this is what MS plaques look like. So they're different sizes, but they're on both sides of the cerebral hemispheres. So those are the plaques. And they're, now we can do a Luxofast blue, which stains myelin blue. And you can see here's the normal gray cortex. Here's the white matter. Here's the angle of the lateral ventricle. But then you notice what? You see an area of demyelination because there's no blue staining here. There's a small little plaque right here in the white matter. Here's another plaque, another plaque, another plaque, another plaque. And here's a nice plaque going in the white matter. The red is referring to the lateral ventricle, but those are the plaques that one sees. Can you see this on a CT scan or MRI? Yes. And so it's a clinical path correlation. You can do, there are findings on the cerebral spinal fluid that also confirms the diagnosis of MS. Now, what's one cranial nerve, which is an extension of white matter of the 12, is the optic nerve. So one of the common presentations that a patient with MS or demyelinating process is visual problems. And this is also important to remember clinically, that because it's an extension of white matter of the optic nerves, they can become demyelinating and leading to visual problems as a consequence compared to the other 11 cranial nerves. This is what the Luxofast blue at higher magnification. Here we see a perivascular infiltrate of T lymphocytes coming in, as well as macrophages. And you can see there's demyelination. You can see how it's spreading from the vessels into the white matter. That's the gray-white junction between the gray matter and the white matter in blue. This is what an MS plaque looks like microscopically. Here we see the reactive astrocytes as a reflection of injury, a nonspecific response. And then you see these are the naked axons. Initially at MS, the axons are preserved, but when you have chronic MS patients, you'll eventually, about 60% of the axons will degenerate and lead to definitely poor neurologic function. MS patients can have slow movements because what happens when you demyelinate, you're going to affect the conduction rate. And so what happens is the sodium potassium channels will redistribute across the entire axon, and so they have slower conduction as a consequence. But then once the neurons degenerate, they have now permanent neurologic loss as a consequence. Then if you look around these blood vessels right here in the right upper corner, you'll notice these round cells with eccentrically placed nuclei. These are macrophages because they're going to come in like the astrocytes as reactive gliosis in response to the immunologic injury to the oligodendrocytes. And some of these round cells that you see here are T lymphocytes. This would be considered an active plaque. Any questions about MS? And there are immunologic treatments to treat the consequences of MS. So now we come to dementia. So you've heard the word dementia. What does dementia mean? What part of the brain, when somebody says you're demented, is affected? What part of the brain? The lobes. What lobe do you think of? The frontal lobes, right? When you say dementia, you have to think of the frontal lobes. There are two forms of treatable dementia that you always have to think of clinically. One is, who can get demented? People who have major depression can have a demented state. People who are taking multiple drugs, some of these drugs, either in themselves or in combination, can lead to a demented state. So dementia refers to loss of executive function, insight, judgment, abstract thinking, behavior is now altered. And that's when you think of a demented state. One of the most common causes organically for a demented state, 40%, is Alzheimer's disease. So Alzheimer's disease is a diagnosed exclusion. Everybody says dementia, and you first thing you think of is Alzheimer's. You got to be careful, because there are other causes of dementia that are treatable. Like I say, somebody who's major depression or on drugs. You can do something by treating the depression, or you take away the drug that's causing it. That's treatable. A second form of dementia cause is hypoxia, ischemia. Because if neurons, if the frontal lobe can't get enough oxygen, you can become demented. So that's the second organic cause. Vascular dementia is called. And they get from hypertension, arterial sclerosis, or diabetes, or just aging. Then you can have dementia with Lewy bodies. And so where are the Lewy bodies occurring? In what part of the lobe? The frontal, because that's where, and Lewy bodies is a molecule called synuclein. And its function is not well understood, and it accumulates because it's a degradation product, and accumulates in those neurons of the frontal lobe. When you hear Lewy body dementia, what lobe do you think of? Frontal. There you go. Okay. Now, guess what the leading cause of death in England is now today is due to dementia. It's now gone beyond cancer. Does dementia, do you think it's easy to work with patients who are demented? Would you, as physical therapists, possibly get frustrated working with people who have dementia? Yes or no? Yes. And this becomes a real issue. So when you are treating people with dementia as a physical therapist, for example, any clinician, you need to be trained first, because it's important. You have to understand how to approach the patient, and it becomes important to understand how you interact in a way that's going to be beneficial to the patient. But it's very difficult and time-consuming. It is a challenge. So it's important to understand what it is and what the different causes are. There are other causes of dementia I'm not going to get into. This is just a listing. Pick's disease affects all the lobes except the frontal and parietal. We talk about prion patients. They become demented in the latter, in their presentation. Huntington's disease, a genetic form of dementia. And there's another one, Parkinson's disease. We'll talk about that with the substantia nigra. The dopaminergic neurons degenerate because of synuclein. You get Lewy bodies there as well. But these are other causes of dementia that are organic. This is Parkinson's disease. This is the patients who have shuffling gait. They have a flat affect. They may have tremors. They're not able to control. They can have what they call clog wheel rigidity when you try to open their arm. They have pill rolling behavior like this when you're rolling a pill or a ball or a marble. And it's a loss. Here you see the substantia nigra right here. This is the cerebral aqueduct going into the fourth ventricle, leaving the third ventricle in between. And you can see the dark pigmentation of the substantia nigra here. And then you can see there's less pigmentation. And so that's what you're destroying the pigmented neurons of substantia nigra. And this is what it looks like in Parkinson's, if you look at the brain parenchyma. This is the melanin-producing cells from, and these are dopaminergic neurons. And here in the, you see this pink body is a Lewy body. Remember we talked about Lewy body dementia? It's the same molecule, but it's collecting in the front neurons of the frontal lobe. Here is the Lewy bodies is a problem accumulating in the substantia nigra, giving you Parkinson's. Can Parkinson's become patients also have Lewy bodies in the frontal lobe? Yes, they can get dementia. Second, they can have dementia as part of their process as well in Parkinson's. So it's spreading. So when we think of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, the problem is that remember that the molecules that are constantly being synthesized and degraded in a constant rate. So when you think of these neurologic diseases, these are problems of degradation of these complex molecules. And because they can't be degraded, what happens? They accumulate and causes neuronal dysfunction or degeneration. And so it's like if you didn't clean out your garbage from your apartment or your house, it would accumulate and accumulate and you become dysfunctional. And this is the problem with these neurodegenerative diseases, the problem of degradation of these molecules. This is what Huntington's disease. It's a genetic disease that occurs in your age group between the 20s and 50s. It's autosomal dominant, and it affects the neurons of the caudate nucleus. And here you see these large lateral ventricles, and there's a loss of white matter. It's also leading to loss of gray matter where the sulci are much more prominent. Here's the optic chiasm, so we know in the middle of the brain, and you can see that there's no real caudate nucleus. It's degenerated over years of the problem here. Now let's talk about Alzheimer's. This is probably the most common group of patients you'll be working with in this population, unless you become physical therapists in the younger population specifically. There are three times that Alzheimer's appears during a human population. The first is patients who have trisomy 21 Down syndrome, because where's this molecule, this amyloid material on what gene? It's an amyloid precursor gene. It's on chromosome 21. So when you think of Downs, they have an accelerated rate for developing Alzheimer's, and they usually start developing symptoms of Alzheimer's in the 20s and 40s, early 40s, or before. It varies. Then you'll have patients who have that come from families that have Alzheimer's, familial Alzheimer's. And these patients start developing Alzheimer's because it's involving a variety of these genes, presenilin 1 and 2. And these occur before the age of 55, typically. So you see the familial form. The vast majority of people who get Alzheimer's, the next period of time is 65 to 90. If you can live past 90 and you don't have Alzheimer's, you're not going to get Alzheimer's after the age of 90. Why? No one knows. So if you can get through 90 and you're sharp as a tack, you're not going to get Alzheimer's. You made it. Then you got to worry about other things every decade. So you can see that there's three peaks of incidence of Alzheimer's. Downs, familial Alzheimer's, and sporadic. Sporadic is by far the most common that one sees. Okay. This is what a brain looks like. This took years to decades. Who's a famous person that lived for decades with this? Was Ronald Reagan. That's why you never saw Ronald Reagan for decades prior to his death, because he had the symptoms of dementia, memory loss, all those things that were going on. And so when you look at these brains, because it's taking years to decades, you lose brain parenchyma because neurons are degenerating, leading in the frontal lobe, hippocampus, and other areas of the brain. Here you can see there's less white matter, larger ventricles, and you see there's the optic chiasm at the base. You see that there's sulci where the valleys between the gyri, because you've lost neuronal bodies, because it's a degradation process over years to decades. Like these neurodegenerative diseases, what do they end up dying of? Because their memory loss, so their ability to eat on a regular basis, others have to do that for them because they can't remember when the last time they ate, so they can become emaciated, malnourished. You can imagine if you're an elderly person that doesn't have economic means or health care insurance and they have Alzheimer's, they live alone, they're not going to live very long because they need constant 24-hour care. They won't remember when they ate, become emaciated, and then obviously they could have poor oral hygiene. They're not going to remember to brush their teeth, and then you have diminished gag and cough reflex, and 99% of these patients will die of aspiration pneumonia. So it takes billions and billions of dollars, obviously, to take care of people who have dementia like Alzheimer's. And because this is going to become a bigger and bigger issue, isn't it? Because people are living what? Longer and longer. And so this is going to be a challenge, to say the least. So there's the salt, okay? This is the morphology or the changes that one sees in the brain. Here we can see these are called neuritic plaques. You increase more and more of these. You see that this is a special stain, silver stain, showing you in the gray cortex. And these neuritic plaques are made of amyloid protein as this molecule accumulates extracellular. And this is a plaque. It has basically neuritic processes of the neurons as well as astrocytes. And this is what is called a neuritic plaque. And this is what it's composed of. There are macrophages, astrocytes, and the amyloid beta amyloid precursor protein, or amyloid 4, that's accumulating extracellularly. Because it's Congo red, you can stain under polarized light and give you apple green birefringence. And so this is lighting up because of the extracellular abnormal accumulation of extracellular protein. This is one of the complications of Alzheimer's, and that is because this amyloid protein can also accumulate in the vessels, the walls of the vessels of the brain, they can become structurally weaker and spontaneously hemorrhage. And here you can have a hemorrhagic stroke in somebody who has Alzheimer's. And they don't have to have hypertension, by the way. But if they do, it's not treated, it'll increase the likelihood, and that's what a hemorrhage looks like in somebody who has Alzheimer's as a complication. So it's either aspiration pneumonia, most common, but a less common consequence as a complication of Alzheimer's is intraparenchymal hemorrhage. Here you see the Congo red staining showing you the material within the blood vessel walls making them structurally weaker. This is the pathogenesis of Alzheimer's. Here you see this transmembrane protein, the amyloid protein, and you have these enzymes called secretases. You notice it's cleaving it into smaller units, so we're able to break it down. But in the case of somebody who does not have the enzymatic machinery or it's defective, the secretase, you get these larger pieces, this amyloid beta peptide that's now going to form amyloid with extracellular producing neuritic plaques. On the inside of the cell, you get a abnormal phosphorylation of an accessory protein called tau protein to the cytoskeletal molecules, the tubulin molecules that make up the cytoskeleton of a neuron, and you get what are called tau proteins as accumulation within the neuron. So this is what the neurofibrillary tangles look like. And here you see, here's a normal neuron right here with the nucleus, and then you see these dark structures running along the length within these affected neurons. Here you can see the tau protein is part of the cytoskeleton and accumulating within the cytosol of the neuron, leading to degeneration. Now, this is what is, when you see nothing but tau proteins like this, this is what people, anybody see the movie Concussion? That was due to football players, wasn't it? This is the lesion that was increased because of constant concussions and brain trauma. And you don't have to have a concussion to develop these. When do you tend to get this in football? It's not during the game, but during practice. If you're practicing every day and you're hitting other players, hitting the ground, that constant brain of jello hitting the skull is causing damage to these neurons, and they get this, what is called chronic traumatic encephalopathy. CTE is the abbreviation for this. Is there any helmet in the world that can prevent this? Only time will tell, won't it? So this is the problem. But when you have the neuritic plaques and these neurofibrillary tangles, this is classic for Alzheimer's. Okay? You don't get the neuritic plaques in chronic traumatic encephalopathy. It's these neurofibrillary tangles. Another important condition you'll come across is patients who have Lou Gehrig's disease or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS. This is a degeneration of the primary motor neurons in the parietal lobe and the lower motor neurons in the anterior horns of your spinal cord. So it's a degeneration of both. So it'll affect the ventral horn and the cortical spinal tract that's going to be important for motor. So it's upper motor function degenerates. And this takes years to decades, depending upon the progression of the disease. So obviously this becomes a real problem. They can die of aspiration, obviously, because it's going to affect the innervation to muscle, because you get what is called neurogenic atrophy, because you're destroying the ability to constantly innervate your muscle. So these are going to lead to a lot of neurogenic atrophy of your skeletal muscle fibers. Etiology or cause for this is unknown at this point. Usually this is a disease of latter part of your age, 30s, or can start in the 40s and 50s, sometimes the 60s. This is a genetic disease involving triple repeat in the Fraxton gene, and this is just for reference, involving both motor neurons. And it's called Friedreich ataxia. So what part of the brain is being affected if I say ataxia? Cerebellum, because it's affecting Purkinje cells. This is not going to be on the exam, but this is just for your reference. The last thing, neoplasia, as we finish this up. What's the most common tumor found in the brain? Metastasis, breast cancer, lung cancer, GI cancer, malignant melanoma, because it's going to be hematogenous spread. The most common tumors that you see clinically in patients are meningiomas. These are tumors that arise from the dura mater, from the arachnoid cells, that are going to cause a compression effect. They tend to be benign. The most common primary malignant tumor of the brain in you and I as adults is glioblastoma multiforme. It's a malignancy, a very aggressive malignancy, of astrocytes. Primary malignant brain tumors account for about 2 to 3% of all cancer deaths in the United States. Clinical manifestations, they can have headache at night or in the early morning, can't be relieved with NSAIDs, seizures, especially when you think of these tumors invading those areas of the brain that's important for controlling function, or this, it could be a meningioma compressing on the brain, leading to seizure activity. Mental changes like memory deficits, concentration, could be affecting the frontal lobe, for example, and other areas that innervate the frontal lobe. And or focal neurologic symptoms based on where it's in the brain, the spinal cord, it just depends. And then when you have a mass effect, whether it's a benign or malignant, you increase the intracranial pressure, and it can lead to herniation as a consequence. Astrocytomas are, because these are stable cells, can increase mutation rate because they are still they can they're reactive and they can divide, and therefore can acquire mutations or in the germline be passed on to increase the likelihood. And these are just terms. You don't have to memorize these terms. The one that you should remember always, this is the most common one you'll see clinically, is glioblastoma multiforme. Blasto, glial, meaning it's glial cells, in this case astrocytes. Blasto, it's highly cellular, and it looks like fetal tissue. And it comes in various forms. It's very pleomorphic or anaplastic tumor. Prognosis at 5 years is 0%. So it's a bad tumor to get. Then there are ones that occur in the posterior fossa, like in children, a pilocystic tumor, astrocytoma. You can have tumors of the oligodendrocytes, oligodendroglioma. Obviously, it affects what? The white matter, typically. This is where you see it as a consequence. Ependymoma is the ependymal cells. In the most common place is the spinal cord. It's the most common spinal cord tumor, involving the ependymal cells that line the ventricular system of the brain, as well as the spinal canal and your spinal cord. Meningioma is a very common tumor, tends to occur in females between ages of 20 and 40, and it's going to be on the outside where the dura is. In children, because what's happening in the first several years of life is rapid expansion and division of cells in the cerebellum, that's why when you think of adult tumors, they're above the cerebellum. When you're a pediatric tumors, they tend to occur in the cerebellum where you have a lot of cell division. Mutations accumulate, and the most common tumor is a medulloblastoma. There's another tumor that occurs in the eyes of newborns, or it can be acquired later on in infancy, is retinoblastoma due to the RB gene, a tumor suppressor. Schwannoma, these are tumor cells, obviously the Schwann cells. And craniopharyngioma is a tumor of the anterior lobe of the pituitary. This is what a glioblastoma multiforme looks like. It's occurring within the white matter. You can see it's very infiltrative. And do you think this is amenable to surgery? What do you think? Yes or no? No. Because if you try to take out that brain with all that tumor, all that hemorrhages, the patient is mutilated, the brain. So surgery is not going to work. How about chemotherapy? Chemotherapy is not going to be very useful either because it can't cross the blood-brain barrier. You can't be injecting it constantly to get in there. So the only thing is really is palliative radiation therapy at this point. Here you can see it's crossed the corpus callosum. And it looks like a butterfly. Glioma is the term. And you can just see that it's deep within the brain, so to try to remove this surgically would be cutting through jello, is essentially, and getting to here without causing major damage. Okay. This is why it's called glioblastoma multiforme. You can see these are bizarre-looking tumor cells of astrocytic origin, and you can see they're pleomorphic, they're multinucleated, and so this has a very bad, bad prognosis. This is what a cerebellar tumor occurs in the juvenile. You can see it's cystic, and it's a tumor, and you can see it's extending. And so this has a better prognosis. Here is a medulloblastoma that one sees in the pediatric group, and it's occurring in the cerebellum in the fourth ventricle. And this is what it looks like. Here's a normal cerebellum to the right upper corner, and you see these very, very cellular-looking, very embryonic cells. And it can produce these rosettes. And it can get through the spinal cord, since there's no lymphatics, go through the subarachnoid space, and here it's encasing the spinal cord, and here's the spinal canal here. Glioblastoma multiforme can also spread throughout the rest of the brain by going through the CSF circulation. Here's what a meningioma looks like. You can see it's compressing on the surface of the brain, and it's arising from the dura. And you get these what are called somoma bodies, these sand-like calcifications. And what's the most common tumor found in the brain? Metastasis. And here you can see malignant melanoma. We'll talk about this tomorrow when we talk about skin. And then brain herniation, showing you the various ways the brain herniates in through the tonsils at the bottom or transitorial through the, and then you see above. And that is the CNS in a nutshell. Any questions? This podcast was recorded by Dr. Henry Sanchez at the University of California, San Francisco.